Appendixes. Appendix 1. The Ecology of Dune. Beyond a critical point within a finite space, freedom diminishes as numbers increase. This is as true of humans in the finite space of a planetary ecosystem as it is of gas molecules in a sealed flask. The human question is not how many can possibly survive within the system, but what kind of existence is possible for those who do survive. Pardo Kynes, first planetologist of Arrakis. The effect of Arrakis on the mind of the newcomer usually is that of overpowering barren land. The stranger might think nothing could live or grow in the open here, that this was the true wasteland that had never been fertile and never would be. To Pardo Kynes, the planet was merely an expression of energy, a machine being driven by its sun. What it needed was reshaping to fit it to man's needs. His mind went directly to the free-moving human population, the Fremen. What a challenge! What a tool they could be! Fremen, an ecological and geological force of almost unlimited potential. A direct and simple man in many ways, Pardo Kynes. One must evade Harkonnen restrictions? Excellent. Then one marries a Fremen woman. When she gives you a Fremen son, you begin with him, with Liet Kynes, and the other children, teaching them ecological literacy, creating a new language with symbols that arm the mind to manipulate an entire landscape, its climate, seasonal limits, and finally to break through all ideas of force into the dazzling awareness of order. There's an internally recognized beauty of motion and balance on any man-healthy planet, Kynes said. You see in this beauty a dynamic stabilizing effect essential to all life. Its aim is simple: to maintain and produce coordinated patterns of greater and greater diversity. Life improves the closed system's capacity to sustain life. Life, all life, is in the service of life. Necessary nutrients are made available to life by life in greater and greater richness as the diversity of life increases. The entire landscape comes alive, filled with relationships and relationships within relationships. This was Pardo Kynes lecturing to a C.H. Warren class. Before the lectures, though, he had to convince the Fremen. To understand how this came about, you must first understand the enormous single-mindedness, the innocence with which he approached any problem. He was not naive. He merely permitted himself no distractions. He was exploring the Arrakis landscape in a one-man ground car one hot afternoon when he stumbled onto a deplorably common scene. Six Harkonnen Bravos, shielded and fully armed, had trapped three Fremen youths in the open behind the shield wall near the village of Windsack. To Kynes, it was a ding-dong battle, more slapstick than real, until he focused on the fact that the Harkonnens intended to kill the Fremen. By this time, one of the youths was down with a severed artery. Two of the Bravos were down as well, but it was still four armed men against two striplings. Kynes wasn't brave. He merely had that single-mindedness and caution. The Harkonnens were killing Fremen. They were destroying the tools with which he intended to remake a planet. He triggered his own shield, waded in, and had two of the Harkonnens dead with a slip tip before they knew anyone was behind them. He dodged a sword thrust from one of the others, slit the man's throat with a neat onsrisure, and left the lone remaining Bravo to the two Fremen youths, turning his full attention to saving the lad on the ground. And save the lad he did, while the sixth Harkonnen was being dispatched. Now here was a pretty kettle of sand trout. The Fremen didn't know what to make of Kynes. They knew who he was, of course. No man arrived on Arrakis without a full dossier finding its way into the Fremen strongholds. They knew him. He was an imperial servant. But he killed Harkonnens. Adults might have shrugged and, with some regret, sent his shade to join those of the six dead men on the ground. But these Fremen were inexperienced youths, and all they could see was that they owed this imperial servant a mortal obligation. Kynes wound up 2 days later in a CH that looked down on Wind Pass. To him, it was all very natural. He talked to the Fremen about water, about dunes anchored by grass, about palmeries filled with date palms, about open canals flowing across the desert. He talked and talked and talked. All around him raged a debate that Kynes never saw. What to do with this madman? He knew the location of a major CH. What to do? What of his words, this mad talk about a paradise on Arrakis? Just talk. He knows too much. But he killed Harkonnens. What of the water burden? When did we owe the Imperium anything? He killed Harkonnens. Anyone can kill Harkonnens. I have done it myself. But what of this talk about the flowering of Arrakis? Very simple. Where is the water for this? He says it is here, and he did save 3 of ours. He saved 3 fools who had put themselves in the way of the Harkonnen Fist, and he has seen Chrisknives. The necessary decision was known for hours before it was voiced. The Tao of a CH tells its members what they must do. Even the most brutal necessity is known. An experienced fighter was sent with a consecrated knife to do the job. 2 watermen followed him to get the water from the body. Brutal necessity. It's doubtful that Kynes even focused on his would-be executioner. He was talking to a group that spread around him at a cautious distance. He walked as he talked. A short circle, gesturing. Open water, Kynes said. Walk in the open without stillsuits. Water for dipping it out of a pond. Portigals. The knife man confronted him. Remove yourself, Kynes said, and went on talking about secret wind traps. He brushed past the man. Kynes's back stood open for the ceremonial blow. What went on in that would-be executioner's mind cannot be known now. Did he finally listen to Kynes and believe? Who knows? But what he did is a matter of record. Uliette was his name. Older Liette. Uliette walked 3 paces and deliberately fell on his own knife, thus removing himself. Suicide. Some say Shai-Hulud moved him. Talk about omens. From that instant, Kynes had but to point, saying, go there. Entire Fremen tribes went. Men died. Women died. Children died. But they went. Kynes returned to his imperial chores, directing the biological testing stations. And now, Fremen began to appear among the station personnel. The Fremen looked at each other. They were infiltrating the system, a possibility they'd never considered. Station tools began finding their way into the CH warrens, especially cutter rays, which were used to dig underground catch basins and hidden wind traps. Water began collecting in the basins. It became apparent to the Fremen that Kynes was not a madman, totally. Just mad enough to be holy. He was one of the Ummah, the Brotherhood of Prophets. The shade of Uliet was advanced to the Sadhus, the throng of heavenly judges. Kynes, direct, savagely intent Kynes, knew that highly organized research is guaranteed to produce nothing new. He set up small unit experiments with regular interchange of data for a swift Tansley effect. Let each group find its own path. They must accumulate millions of tiny facts. He organized only isolated and rough run-through tests to put their difficulties into perspective. Core samplings were made throughout the blood. Charts were developed on the long drifts of weather that are called climate. He found that in the wide belt contained by the 70-degree lines, north and south, temperatures for thousands of years hadn't gone outside the 254 to 332 degrees absolute range, and that this belt had long growing seasons where temperatures ranged from 284 to 302 degrees absolute, the bonanza range for terraform life. Once they solved the water problem. "When will we solve it?" the Fremen asked. "When will we see Arrakis as a paradise?" In the manner of a teacher answering a child who has asked the sum of 2 plus 2, Kynes told them, "From 300 to 500 years." A lesser folk might have howled in dismay. But the Fremen had learned patience from men with whips. It was a bit longer than they had anticipated, but they all could see that the blessed day was coming. They tightened their sashes and went back to work. Somehow, the disappointment made the prospect of paradise more real. The concern on Arrakis was not with water, but with moisture. Pets were almost unknown, stock animals rare. Some smugglers employed the domesticated desert ass, the Kulon, but the water price was high even when the beasts were fitted with modified stillsuits. Kynes thought of installing reduction plants to recover water from the hydrogen and oxygen locked in native rock, but the energy cost factor was far too high. The polar caps, disregarding the false sense of water security they gave the peons, held far too small an amount for his project, and he already suspected where the water had to be. There was that consistent increase of moisture at median altitudes and in certain winds. There was that primary clue in the air balance. 23% oxygen, 75.4% nitrogen, and 0.023% carbon dioxide, with the trace gases taking up the rest. There was a rare native root plant that grew above the 2,500-meter level in the northern temperate zone. A tuber 2 meters long yielded half a liter of water. And there were the terraform desert plants. The tougher ones showed signs of thriving if planted in depressions lined with dew precipitators. Then Kynes saw the salt pan. His thopter, flying between stations far out on the bled, was blown off course by a storm. When the storm passed, there was the pan, a giant oval depression some 300 kilometers on the long axis. A glaring white surprise in the open desert. Kynes landed, tasted the pan's storm-cleaned surface. Salt. Now he was certain. There had been open water on Arrakis. Once. He began re-examining the evidence of the dry wells where trickles of water had appeared and vanished, never to return. Kynes set his newly trained Fremen limnologists to work. Their chief clue leathery scraps of matter sometimes found with the spice mass after a blow. This had been ascribed to a fictional sand trout in Fremen folk stories. As facts grew into evidence, a creature emerged to explain these leathery scraps, a sand swimmer that blocked off water into fertile pockets within the porous lower strata, below the 280-degree absolute line. This water stealer died by the millions in each spice blow. A 5-degree change in temperature could kill it. The few survivors entered a semi-dormant cyst hibernation to emerge in 6 years as small, about 3 meters long, sandworms. Of these, only a few avoided their larger brothers and pre-spice water pockets to emerge into maturity as the giant Shai-Hulud. Water is poisonous to Shai-Hulud, as the Fremen had long known from drowning the rare, stunted worm of the Minor Erg to produce the awareness spectrum narcotic they call Water of Life. The stunted worm is a primitive form of Shai-Hulud that reaches a length of only about 9 meters. Now, they had the circular relationship. Little Maker to pre-spice mass. Little Maker to Shai-Hulud. Shai-Hulud to scatter the spice upon which fed microscopic creatures called sand plankton. The sand plankton, food for Shai-Hulud, growing, burrowing, becoming little makers. Kynes and his people turned their attention from these great relationships and focused now on microecology. First, the climate. The sand surface often reached temperatures of 344 to 350 degrees absolute. A foot below ground, it might be 55 degrees cooler. A foot above ground, 25 degrees cooler. Leaves or black shade could provide another 18 degrees of cooling. Next, the nutrients. Sand of Arrakis is mostly a product of worm digestion. Dust, the truly omnipresent problem there, is produced by the constant surface creep, the saltation movement of sand. Coarse grains are found on the downwind sides of dunes. The windward side is packed smooth and hard. Old dunes are yellow, oxidized. Young dunes are the color of the parent rock, usually gray. Downwind sides of old dunes provided the first plantation areas. The Fremen aimed first for a cycle of poverty grass with peat-like hair cilia to intertwine, mat, and fix the dunes by depriving the wind of its big weapon, movable grains. Adaptive zones were laid out in the deep south, far from Harkonnen watchers. The mutated poverty grasses were planted first along the downwind, slip face, of the chosen dunes that stood across the path of the prevailing westerlies. With the downwind face anchored, the windward face grew higher and higher, and the grass was moved to keep pace. Giant sifts, long dunes with sinuous crest of more than 1,500 meters height, were produced this way. When barrier dunes reached sufficient height, the windward faces were planted with tougher sword grasses. Each structure on a base about six times as thick as its height was anchored, fixed. Now they came in with deeper plantings, ephemerals, kinopods, pigweeds, and amaranth to begin, then scotch broom, low lupine, vine eucalyptus, the type adapted for Caladan's northern reaches, dwarf tamarisk, shore pine, then the true desert growths, candelilla, saguaro, and bisnaga, the barrel cactus. Where it would grow, they introduced camel sage, onion grass, goby feather grass, wild alfalfa, burrow bush, sand verbena, evening primrose, incense bush, smoke tree, creosote bush. They turned then to the necessary animal life, burrowing creatures to open the soil and aerate it. Kit Fox, Kangaroo Mouse, Desert Hare, Sand Terrapin. And the predators to keep them in check. Desert Hawk, Dwarf Owl, Eagle and Desert Owl. And insects to fill the niches these couldn't reach. Scorpion, Centipede, Trapdoor Spider, the Biting Wasp, and the Wormfly. And the Desert Bat to keep watch on these. Now came the crucial test. Date palms, cotton, melons, coffee, medicinals. More than 200 selected food plant types to test and adapt. The thing the ecologically illiterate don't realize about an ecosystem, Kynes said, is that it's a system. A system. A system maintains a certain fluid stability that can be destroyed by a misstep in just one niche. A system has order, a flowing from point to point. If something dams that flow, order collapses. The untrained might miss that collapse until it was too late. That's why the highest function of ecology is the understanding of consequences. Had they achieved a system? Kynes and his people watched and waited. The Fremen now knew what he meant by an open-end prediction to 500 years. A report came up from the Palmeries. At the desert edge of the plantings, the sand plankton is being poisoned through interaction with the new forms of life. The reason? Protein incompatibility. Poisonous water was forming there, which the Arrakis life would not touch. A barren zone surrounded the plantings, and even Shai-Hulud would not invade it. Kynes went down to the Palmeries himself, a 20-thumper trip, in a palanquin, like a wounded man or a reverend mother, because he never became a sand rider. He tested the barren zone. It stank to heaven and came up with a bonus, a gift from Arrakis. The addition of sulfur and fixed nitrogen converted the barren zone to a rich plant bed for terraform life. The plantings could be advanced at will. Does this change the timing? The Fremen asked. Kynes went back to his planetary formulae. Wind trap figures were fairly secure by then. He was generous with his allowances, knowing he couldn't draw neat lines around ecological problems. A certain amount of plant cover had to be set aside to hold dunes in place. A certain amount for foodstuffs, both human and animal. A certain amount to lock moisture in root systems and to feed water out into surrounding parched areas. They'd mapped the roving cold spots on the open bled by this time. These had to be figured into the formulae. Even Shai-Hulud had a place in the charts. He must never be destroyed, else spice wealth would end. But his inner digestive factory, with its enormous concentrations of aldehydes and acids, was a giant source of oxygen. A medium worm, about 200 meters long, discharged into the atmosphere as much oxygen as 10 square kilometers of green-growing photosynthesis surface. He had the guild to consider. The spice bribe to the guild for preventing weather satellites and other watchers in the skies of Arrakis already had reached major proportions. Nor could the Fremen be ignored. Especially the Fremen, with their wind traps and irregular landholdings organized around water supply. The Fremen with their new ecological literacy and their dream of cycling vast areas of Arrakis through a prairie phase into forest cover. From the charts emerged a figure. Kynes reported it. 3%. If they could get 3% of the green plant element on Arrakis involved in forming carbon compounds. They'd have their self-sustaining cycle. But how long? The Fremen demanded. Oh, that. About 350 years. So it was true as this Uma had said in the beginning. The thing would not come in the lifetime of any man now living, nor in the lifetime of their grandchildren 8 times removed. But it would come. The work continued. Building, planting, digging, training the children. Then Kynes the Uma was killed in the cave-in at Plaster Basin. By this time his son, Liet Kynes, was 19, a full Fremen and sand rider who had killed more than 100 Harkonnens. The imperial appointment for which the elder Kynes already had applied in the name of his son was delivered as a matter of course. The rigid class structure of the Faufreluches had its well-ordered purpose here. The son had been trained to follow the father. The course had been set by this time. The ecological Fremen were aimed along their way. Liet Kynes had only to watch and nudge and spy upon the Harkonnens until the day his planet was afflicted by a hero. The space gave a different flavor and sense to ideas of creation. That difference is seen even in the highest religious movements of the period. All through religion, the feeling of the sacred was touched by anarchy from the outer dark. It was as though Jupiter, in all his descendant forms, retreated into the maternal darkness, to be superseded by a female immanence filled with ambiguity and with the face of many terrors. The ancient formulae intertwined, tangled together as they were fitted to the needs of new conquests and new heraldic symbols. It was a time of struggle between beast demons on the one side and the old prayers and invocations on the other. There was never a clear decision. During this period, it was said that Genesis was reinterpreted, permitting God to say, "Increase and multiply, and fill the universe, and subdue it, and rule over all manner of strange beasts and living creatures in the infinite airs, on the infinite earths, and beneath them." It was a time of sorceresses whose powers were real. The measure of them is seen in the fact they never boasted how they grasped the firebrand. Then came the Butlerian Jihad, 2 generations of chaos. The god of machine logic was overthrown among the masses, and a new concept was raised. Man may not be replaced. Those 2 generations of violence were a thalamic pause for all humankind. Men looked at their gods and their rituals and saw that both were filled with that most terrible of all equations, fear over ambition. Hesitantly, the leaders of religions whose followers had spilled the blood of billions began meeting to exchange views. It was a move encouraged by the Spacing Guild, which was beginning to build its monopoly over all interstellar travel, and by the Bene Gesserit, who were banding the sorceresses. Out of those first ecumenical meetings came 2 major developments. 1. The realization that all religions had at least 1 common commandment, "Thou shalt not disfigure the soul." 2. The commission of ecumenical translators. CET convened on a neutral island of old Earth, spawning ground of the mother religions. They met in the common belief that there exists a divine essence in the universe. Every faith with more than 1 million followers was represented, and they reached a surprisingly immediate agreement on the statement of their common goal. "We are here to remove a primary weapon from the hands of disputant religions." That weapon? the claim to possession of the one and only revelation. Jubilation at this sign of profound accord proved premature. For more than a standard year, that statement was the only announcement from CET. Men spoke bitterly of the delay. Troubadours composed witty, biting songs about the 121 old cranks, as the CET delegates came to be called. The name arose from a ribald joke which played on the CET initials and called the delegates cranks, effing turners. One of the songs, Brown Repose, has undergone periodic revival and is popular even today. Consider lays, brown repose, and the tragedy in all of those cranks, all those cranks. So lays through all your days. Time has told for Milord Sandwich.